Yesterday, on our show, we got a rare opportunity to look into the future and learn some coronavirus lessons from Italy, where they are ahead of us in the infection curve. But what about lessons from the past? Turns out they're available too, from the 1918 flu outbreak right here in Boston. Joining us now via Skype is Robert Allison, professor of history at Suffolk University and author of a number of books, including The American Revolution and A Short History of Boston. Professor Allison, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana.
Also with us on the line is Dr. Skip Desjardin. Skip Desjardin. He's the head of sports for YouTube TV and author of September 1918, War, Plague, and the World Series. Skip, welcome to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
I almost accidentally gave you a medical degree there. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I don't want anybody coming to seek any advice from me on a medical basis.
Fair enough. All right. Professor Allison, I do want to start with you. Boston was actually, I didn't really realize that Boston was basically a ground zero for the Spanish flu in 1918, the site of the first major outbreak in the nation. Why? Why did that happen here?
Well, it really happened here because of the mass mobilization for the war. That is, Boston was the major shipping point for getting men, supplies, nurses off to Europe. So the South Boston waterfront was actually where the first flu cases were reported at what's now Commonwealth Pier, and very quickly overwhelmed the medical establishment in the city. And plus, you had 50,000 servicemen out at Fort Devens. So between these two places, you have, and also the flu had started somewhat mysteriously. We know the first cases in the United States were out in Kansas back in the spring, and then the virus had migrated to Europe and then to Asia and back, kind of misnamed the Spanish flu because the first cases were reported in Spain, and Spain being a neutral country, the Allies were kind of sore that a flu bug started there.
It started in Kansas but was first reported in Spain?
Well, we didn't have the kind of global system of communication that we do today. So there were flu cases being reported in Kansas, flu cases being reported in Spain, flu cases being reported in other parts of the world. No one really was connecting these particular dots. And three major shipping points in the Atlantic, Dakar in Senegal, Brest in France, and Boston in North America, really were the kind of the triangle through which the virus spread and mutated as it was spreading.
So, Skip, as you write in your book, this kind of all came to a head in September of 1918. Why was that month kind of the perfect storm for the virus?
Well, as the professor explained, the first cases showed up on the waterfront in Boston, and the movement of troops, the movement of sailors, the movement of civilians in and out of military facilities meant that it spread very quickly. Much like coronavirus today, you could be infected for quite some time before your symptoms showed up. And so the foremost expert on infectious diseases in the entire country, Dr. Milton Rosenau, was stationed at the Chelsea Naval Hospital at the Boston waterfront, and he saw patient number one. He knew what it was. He did exactly the right thing in treating and isolating that sailor, but it was too late. That person had already infected too many other people, and they couldn't contain the virus. And in many ways, the math of a pandemic is sometimes more frightening than the science of it.
So for either of you, you know, hygiene is such an important part of our fight of the coronavirus, constant disinfecting surfaces, washing hands. What was daily life like in Boston then, and what kind of hygiene was available to try to fight the spread?
It was a lot dirtier then. In fact, you see the warnings about spitting on the street. That was the 1918 equivalent of don't spit on the street, keep your windows open. By the way, my grandmother at the time was working selling drugstore supplies. So she would come up from New York on the train, and people she saw on Monday taking their orders, by the time she came back on Thursday, those people were dead. The virus hit very quickly. But she also said people were crazy to get Listerine. They thought Listerine could stop the spread of the virus. And the head of the city's public health commission thought the biggest thing we can do is clean up the restaurants. The restaurants have dirty pots and pans, and he thought that was really a way of spreading the virus. Probably not, but we learn things from this that maybe we should always remember. Wash your hands. Don't spit on the street. use Listerine. These are good recommendations at any time, and it's unfortunate we need a pandemic to remind us.
Well, and I guess I should ask then, does that mean that the Spanish flu was aerosolized or in droplets, and that's how it spread the way coronavirus is now?
Yeah, it absolutely was. And one of the mitigating factors was that because people were not yet symptomatic in the city, they took no sort of social distancing precautions.
Right.
Here was the World Series being... Yeah, here was the World Series being played at Fenway Park and putting 35,000 people shoulder to shoulder inside the park. And there were also five enormous parades in the city during that month, from Labor Day to Liberty Loans, which just created a soup of microbes and infection.
So, okay, you're making me panicky just listening to this. Skip, you're also making me think maybe it was, in fact, a really good idea to cancel sports under the circumstances. I mean, I'm picturing a World Series and everybody's, you know, sharing peanuts and standing together. Professor Allison, so talk a little bit about the early government response as this began to unfold at the state level or local or federal.
Well, the governor happened to be out of town, and the mayor didn't take – there's actually a famous photograph of Mayor Peters getting a flu shot. This was to show that we're handling things. And the public health commissioner was not as concerned as he might have been. There are – as Skip said, the Navy's response was absolutely what they should do, isolate these the sailors. However, the city and the state were a little slower to respond to this, not to fault them. I mean, they wanted to avoid panic. So the guy who is actually in charge on the ground here was Calvin Coolidge, who is elected governor in November, and he's acting as lieutenant governor. So they are coordinating among these different agencies, which often don't get along very well together. The state public health commission, the city public health commission, the Red Cross, the city government, the schools. The superintendent of schools didn't think it was necessary to cancel school because he thought the kids would be safer in school than they would be at home. And in school, they have trained nurses. And what quickly happened was the doctors and nurses started getting sick, too. So they were stricken with the flu and weren't able to tend to this huge number of patients. They did set up Navy wound up setting up tents on in Brookline. There's a huge field covered with tents for the sick personnel from the Navy. So the response very, very quickly, the state and the city were overwhelmed. And there was an expectation at the beginning, the virus, since it's so strong, it's going to burn itself out pretty quickly.
So, go ahead, and then I'll ask.
There was also a political undertone to all of that, in which the federal government and to a lesser extent the state government had a vested interest in people not panicking, as the professor said, but in continuing to go about their daily lives. They needed people to be out at these parades to get worked up and excited about the war and buy war bonds.
Right.
They needed people to go to work on the factory floor to build ships and manufacture guns and turn out boots and blankets and sort of telling people that they should stay home, as good as that might be for their health, would have been a tremendous drag, not only on the economy, but on the war effort.
So wait, was that an actual sort of moral calculus? Am I hearing, we know this is bad, we know this is an outbreak, we know we should tell people to stay away, but if we do, the war effort will suffer, and therefore we're not going to tell people what we know? Is that what you're saying?
I think it was less a calculus than it was so ingrained in society and in government that every aspect of our daily lives should revolve around supporting the war effort, that alternatives never occurred to them.
So, Robert, what is your assessment of the flow of information from government? How long into this before the response was proportionate to the risk?
Well, quite honestly, the federal government's focus, as Skip said, was on the war. And that was the entire focus. Great novel, if you're interested, by Catherine Ann Porter's Pale Horse, Pale Rider, when she's stricken with a flu. And in the background, there is this current about selling war bonds. Who has bought more war bonds? That was really the focus, which is why, as Skip said, we needed the parades. We needed these things. So it's less the case of the government sinisterly saying, we're not going to tell people what we know. The government really didn't know all that much. It was the federal government, the city government, the state government weren't really set up to deal with a crisis like this. It was the doctors, the public health commission, and the Navy doctors. And information wasn't spreading as quickly then as it does now. And fortunately, misinformation didn't spread as quickly either. So The city was really overwhelmed, I think, and because Boston, the city and the state have kind of different interests, there's always been that kind of a clash.
Skip, looking back now in your research for the book, is there any consensus of something that should have been done then, that the city should have done and didn't do?
Yeah, I think the consensus is they should have acted faster and earlier, and taken the kind of steps that we have taken today. Close the schools, close restaurants, close theaters. And it just didn't happen. And Bob's right that misinformation prevailed. You know, at one point in the middle of September 1918, the U.S. Surgeon General put out a statement that said to avoid the Spanish flu, people should not wear tight shoes.
What?
Right. Yeah.
So that was the level of information that was coming from the government. Yeah. And so you can see why thousands and thousands of people were stricken. And if you look at the numbers of how many people were sick and died just in the city of Boston back then, compared to what we're dealing with today, it is astounding.
It is.
So
3,500 people died by early October. 3,500. There were hundreds of people dying every day. People in South Boston remember the caskets stacked on a lawn across from a funeral home. Remember, many of the sailors were at Commonwealth Pier. But I mean, it simply overwhelmed our capacity both to fathom it and to deal with this huge tragedy.
And to be clear, when was the first case? Was it August?
Like the last couple of days of August, a sailor checked into the Naval Hospital.
And you got 3,500 people dead by October just in Boston.
Yeah, we've got 250 cases in Massachusetts today, total.
Right.
In the third week of September 1918, there were 85,000 cases in the state of Massachusetts.
Okay. All right. So, Robert Ellison, how does it end?
Well, it ends because the virus does ultimately wear itself out. Another really striking thing about this epidemic was it mainly struck young, healthy people. People between the ages of about 18 and 30 were the most heavily affected. In fact, their death rate skyrockets. And later on, it catches up with the old and the young, who usually are the victims of an epidemic like this. So it ends as viruses do. The virus pretty much burns itself out. I'm not an epidemiologist. You've had plenty of those. I mean, I'm not a doctor,
have,
as Skip said. I'm not that kind of doctor, so don't ask me medical advice.
All right, fair enough. Skip, one last lesson that you took from your research in writing this book that's important for the city of Boston today.
Listen to doctors. Listen to scientists, because math and science are true. Do not listen to politicians.
All right. And on that note, that is Skip Desjardins. He's the head of sports for YouTube TV and author of September 1918, War, Plague, and the World Series. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Robert Allison is
Thank
a
you.
Professor of history at Suffolk University and author of a number of books, including A Short History of Boston. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tiziana.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, and that's Boston's NPR news station.